can open your Bibles to John chapter 1 if you'd like. That line that Paul gives to Titus just blows me away. Put everything in order. That's an intimidating thing for any person to try to do. That's not something that I think that I can do. I'm so happy that I'm not the only person here at church. I need all of you so much. I need all of your help. I know I didn't get a chance to hand out a handout to everybody this morning. If anyone wants a copy of the handout for the sermon, if you raise your hand, Dan can hand those out to you now. Oh. I know we're excited to continue to grow our elders here and continue to grow as a church and a family together, and I pray that that this will just continue to be a blessing for all of us. I want to continue looking at some stories about Jesus. I've talked about this before, being a habit that I got into a number of years ago. Every summer I enjoy presenting lessons about Jesus. We're going to begin by one very, very little story as an example in John chapter 1, but we're going to look at, in my opinion, I don't even know if the story in John chapter 1 is a story of Jesus addressing sin. It could be, but I want to talk about the way that Jesus interacted with people. When we read the stories of Jesus, it reveals a collective wisdom that's found in all of his interactions altogether. When we read John chapter 1 in just a moment, we're not going to find three tools or here are four wisdom nuggets. I don't know if that's what we get in all of these stories, but altogether, we start to get an altogether picture and an altogether behavior so that when we are interacting with others in our own circumstances, we can remember back to what did Jesus do? You know, what would Jesus do was a great reminder, but we can also remember what he did and what he did do that one time. So when I am encountering my experiences, I can remember those. In John chapter 1, just 43 through 51, the next day Jesus decided to go to Galilee. He found Philip and said to him, "Follow me." Now Philip was from Bethsaida, a city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" And Philip said to him, "Come and see." Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him and said of him, "Behold, an Israelite indeed in whom there is no deceit." And Nathanael said to him, "How did you know me?" And Jesus answered him, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." Nathanael answered him, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." And Jesus answered him, "Because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree, did you believe? You'll see greater things than these." And he said to him, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." Not only does the brother invite Nathanael to come and see, but Jesus also, after impressing Nathanael with the one statement, continues to invite Nathanael, "Come along and see." And I think that that's one of the great things that Jesus does in all of the stories of the Gospels. He is inviting us to come and see and hear and learn from him and from his behaviors. There are teachings. Jesus says, "Thou shalt not," and we need to not. And Jesus says, "Thou shalt," and we need to shout. But there's also the way he interacts, and we're going to learn from those interactions as well. I want to look at Jesus addressing sin. I don't know if this story is about sin. I have heard someone say, when Jesus said, "I saw you under that tree," nowadays you'd imagine him on his phone, and just the thought of Jesus knowing what I was looking at on my phone when I thought I was by myself and no one could see me. You know, maybe Nathanael was sinning. Maybe Nathanael had something bad in his heart, and Jesus said, "You know, I saw you there." Now, I don't know if that's a speculation. But that's an indication of just how intimately Jesus knows who and what we are and what we're doing. And I think that that's really compelling. When Jesus addresses sin, is he the angry and demanding God that people see in the Old Testament? When Jesus addresses sin, is he the loving and merciful God that people see in the New Testament? Of course, the answer is yes, right? God is God. And Jesus is serious and has demands and loving and merciful. And we need to read through these stories and figure out how to combine justice and mercy, how to combine the condemnation and the grace, just as Jesus did as a person when he was walking around and interacting with people. I want to look at two stories first in Mark chapter 9. In these, I see a very calm correction. I don't even know if you want to say, I think what they're doing is sinful, but he doesn't necessarily call out and say, you are the sinner, or you are the man. He just calmly redirects people. I'm going to go ahead and read both interactions, starting in Mark chapter 9 and verse 33. And they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, what were you discussing on the way? But they kept silent, for on the way they had argued with one another about who was the greatest. And he sat down and called the 12 and said to them, if anyone would be first, he must be last of all and servant of all. And he took a child and put him in the midst of them, and taking him in his arms, he said to them, whoever receives such child in my name receives me, and whoever receives not me, but him who sent me. John said to him, teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he was not following us. And Jesus said, do not stop him, for no one who does a mighty work in my name will soon be able afterward to speak evil of me. For the one who is not against us is for us. For truly I say to you, whoever gives you a cup of water to drink because you belong to Christ will by no means lose his reward. There is improper thinking in these individuals. They're not only having a discussion about who's the greatest, they're arguing about who's the greatest. How can you even have a discussion calmly about who's the greatest? It's always going to devolve into arguing because it's a bad discussion to begin with. They're arguing about who is the greatest, or in that second story, they're refusing someone because they're not following along. What were you discussing on the way? What I find interesting is it's not because Jesus didn't know. Jesus let them do their thing. They were normal human people. And we might be tempted sometimes, and I don't think it's an evil phrase, well, it's just human nature, but no, that's worldly nature. You know, we need to be more than human. We need to be divine. We have a gift of God, and we need to be more than the apes and the dogs that run around on the globe, and we need to be something greater than that. And so he let them do this lowly, worldly thing. He let them have their discussion, but he didn't ignore it. And he didn't forget it. And that's something that we can learn. We're not going to stop everybody from doing everything. We can let things happen, but we need to remember that, and we need to come back to these things. And when he speaks to them, he doesn't just trash them. He doesn't condemn them. He's not necessarily hard. Is he direct? We can question about that and think about that. But he does redirect them into correct thinking. He didn't say, thou shalt not argue, especially not about who's great. He gives them a new direction. If anyone would be first, he must be last and servant. He just kind of drops that. He does give them another explanation. He grabs a kid and says, whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. And I think that these are very powerful ideas. His instructions require a lot of thinking. I find that they are oddly black and white. Okay, I need to not be first. I need to be last. That's a very clear idea. All right. How do I do that at breakfast? How do I do that as I'm driving down the road? And it's not always going to be clear in each, like the idea is clear, but the implementation is not necessarily going to be clear. We need to think about this. When Jesus gives us these instructions, we need to think about that. And that's something that Jesus does really well. And so I can say, we all need to give instructions to people that are so deep and wise that they think about it. Well, good. There's only so much that I'm capable of doing, giving people instructions that are wise. But we can repeat the things that Jesus said. And if we remember some of these lines, we can help people get in the right direction. And if they're arguing, and if they're trying to be first, and they're trying to be great, we can remind them that being first is not the first thing to do. We need to be last and servants, and we need to welcome in little ones. And that needs to be our life behavior. He gives us the correct means, he gives us the correct ideals, and then he demands that we are introspective and that we reflect and that we meditate about it. He puts that in our lap to deal with and to think about. And then we have this next story. We tried to stop him because they weren't following us, and Jesus says, don't stop them. They had this tendency towards being exclusive. You know, We are on brand, and they're not on our brand, and they're kind of faking it, and if they're not walking the way we're walking, we don't want them to walk at all. And Jesus says, don't do that. And he frames their thinking to be more merciful. He's trying to get them to be open. He shatters their ideals of being, we are the cool in group. But he doesn't necessarily permit just, well, it doesn't matter if somebody out there is sinning. He's getting them to think about themselves and think about what they are doing as they evaluate others. And so we have this great, simple instruction that demands a lot of thinking for each circumstance. I like these two interactions. I don't know if reading through these stories, I know what I'm going to say to my kid when he does this. I don't know if I have that kind of an answer. But when I read through the way Jesus reasoning and interacting with others, I'm trying to imprint it in my mind and in my heart so that I'll do a much better job when I'm interacting with you or with my children. But we also see that Jesus has no fear when he is speaking out about things like hypocrisy. If you jump to chapter 11 and verse 27, I was just thinking through the stories of the gospel. What are times when Jesus addresses something that's wrong? And that first example, I'm trying to go from pretty mild to maybe more extreme reactions. And that first one, they're a mess. And he just kind of gives them some wise instructions. He doesn't fuss at them. He doesn't yell at them, but he tells them what they need to know. I think that they had a lot of opportunity back there in chapter 9 to feel ashamed about themselves without getting yelled at, right? Look at what Jesus does in this paragraph, Mark 11, verse 27. And they came again to Jerusalem, and as he was walking in the temple, the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders came to him, and they said to him, by what authority do you do these things, and who gave you this authority to do them? Jesus said to them, I'll ask you one question. Answer me, and I'll tell you by what authority I do these things. Was the baptism of John from heaven or from man? Answer me. And they discussed it with one another, saying, if we say from heaven, he'll say, then why didn't you believe him? But if we say from man, they are afraid of the people, for they all held that John was really a prophet. So they answered Jesus, we do not know. And Jesus said to them, neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things. I love this moment. Can you see that he's turned up the intensity from the last interaction? Right? I don't know if harsh is the right word, but he has turned it up a notch. He asks this question to do two things. He says, I am not going to indulge your hypocritical behavior. So if you answer that question, and by answering it, you're going to have to reveal yourself and show whether you're going to be a hypocrite or not, you know, show it out. If you're willing to do that, then I will also answer you. And so it just draws it to a complete halt. And the very act of that question, he's revealing their hypocrisy. He makes it evident with this question. If you don't have the nerve to answer my question, right? He's letting them know that he, Jesus, I'm pointing at me like I'm not Jesus, you know, that he sees it. I see that you're a hypocrite. You don't even have the nerve to answer this question about what do you think about John? Because you don't want to be held responsible for ignoring John, but you also don't want other people to not like you for not liking John. He also makes sure that they can see their own hypocrisy. You can't reason in verse 31, well, if we say from heaven, he'll yell at us. But if we say from man, then the people would yell at us. It's easy to forget that you're a hypocrite. That's why hypocrisy works so well. We deceive ourselves first and then try to deceive everybody else. When Jesus asked this question, they might have been walking around in innocency for so long, and now it's right in front of them. They can't ignore their own hypocrisy. I love this question. He just draws it out. And the third person that finds out is everyone else that was there and listening in. They're going to go, oh, yeah. Ooh, are they going to answer this question? Are they going to have the nerve to speak the truth to Jesus, or are they going to slink away in their hypocrisy? I think that this is a very impressive moment. Hypocrisy isn't just improper thinking like we saw in the last story. Hypocrisy is thinking the wrong way and just continuing to act that way. And it's such a mess. So Jesus draws it out. He makes it so that their hypocrisy is not hidden. It's in the light. And he just affords no time for their hypocrisy. I'm not going to give you any more time than this. He holds up the mirror so that they can see themselves. And they know that he can see them. And everyone else can see them too. He holds their sin up, and if they refuse to address their sin, well, what's he going to do? What sort of obligation does Jesus have to someone like that? Sir, you are on fire. No, I put on flame retardant clothing. All right, talk to you later. I'll talk to you later. And this is something that we can start thinking about. Now, none of us are Jesus, so none of us are going to do this as well as Jesus. But we need to get to the point, like Jesus, to realize if someone is being a hypocrite, how obligated am I to continue and to continue and to continue? Jesus sent out those teachers, and he told them, you know, if they don't listen to you, wipe the dust off your feet, and you move on. And there's something to learn from this. If they're being hypocritical, find out a way to say, you are being a hypocrite, and they will very quickly say, oh, no, I'm not. Okay. But that's what we're obligated to do, is to point out sin. Here's one trick to be able to point out hypocrisy to others. This is a trick. It's not a trick. But this is what Jesus did. He lived without hypocrisy in any way whatsoever. That's not a trick with Jesus. With a human being, it feels like a trick. Oh, all I got to do is be sincere and truthful every moment of the day. If you do, when you draw something out to somebody and they see it in themselves, they're not going to have anything to throw back at you. So this is hard, but we need to live this way. We need to not put up with hypocrisy in others. We need to point out sin. We need to see it, make sure that other people see it. And if they're not willing to listen, well, we need to move on the way that Jesus did. This is not clearly his first interaction with the Pharisees and the scribes and the elders of the people. We're towards the end of the Gospel of Mark. He's given them some time before, and so I think that adds to this situation. Well, let's look at Mark chapter 10. This is a story I want to, not just a story, but an idea that I want to dwell a little bit on. Jesus confronted sin head on, which technically he's been doing in all of these examples, right? When he hears them talking knuckleheaded stuff, he says, what were you talking about? And he brings it up, and he gives them something to think about. When they are coming up to him with this hypocritical attitude so that they can condemn him, he brings it up and draws it out to them. But this is where I'm saying he's confronting sin head on, because it's a lot more explicit. He's going to say it out loud. Look at Mark chapter 10. I think this parable of the rich young man has been in the last Wednesday evening talks and sermons for the last month. We're all thinking about this story right now, and I think that's great. As he was setting out on his journey, a man ran up and knelt before him and asked him, good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus said to him, why do you call me good? No one's good except God alone. You know the commandments. Do not murder. Do not commit adultery. Do not steal. Do not bear false witness. Do not defraud. Honor your father and your mother. And he said to him, teacher, all these I have kept from my youth. And Jesus, looking at him, loved him and said to him, you lack one thing. Go sell all that you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. And come follow me. Disheartened by the saying, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. Now this is, again, I think Jesus has been confronting sin head on, but this is just flat out. You have one sin. You have one thing. You have one lack. And he's saying it in black and white. We need to remember that if you only lack one thing, it's too much. It's too much. Have you ever thought, oh, wow, what a lucky dude. He only had one problem in his life. I feel like I have so many more I'm trying to handle. Apparently, one is too many. Jesus called him out on that. And that one was too much for him to handle, which is really sad. But what did Jesus do? Looking at him, he loved him, and he said to him, we need to look, right? We need to connect with this individual. If we're going to have any effect in speaking to somebody, in helping them, and trying to draw them and to get them saved from sin, it's not we who save them from sin, but if we are going to try to get them to see the salvation that they so desperately need, we need to look and have a heart-to-heart connection with them. Because if I don't like you, how am I going to speak with you? How am I going to connect with you? If I don't connect with you, how are you ever going to listen to me? How is there ever going to be some sort of care that's going on? And he loved him. He had compassion for him. I love this moment here. He looks at him, and he had this heart-filled connection with him. He didn't just see a loser when he saw this sinner. He saw someone that he loved and he cared about. every single human being is made in the image of God and loved by God, and we need to love them. One of my favorite quotes about this idea: his imperfections is always smaller than my obligation to love. And they might have a lot of problems and a lot of imperfection, and I need to love. And the command to love is way bigger than their problems. And then Jesus spoke. We connect, we love, and we absolutely speak. We speak the words. Ephesians 4:15, rather, speaking truth in love, we are to grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ. We speak truth in love. A lot of us really, well, that's the truth. Told him what he needed to hear. In love. Oh, I didn't do that part at all. Like, we need to speak the truth, and we need to speak it in love. How can we speak to somebody without a connection and without a love for them? And how, after connecting with someone and loving them, how could we not speak? Of course we're going to help. And this is what Jesus is doing. And he tells him, man, Jesus, you called him out on that sin right in front of everybody? Like, the one thing that he's got a problem with? You talked about that one thing? Of course. Clear is kind. Well, I don't know. You seem to be doing all right. Maybe you could work on giving. I don't know. Just an idea. That's not clear. That's deceitful. You have a problem. And I need to talk with you about this problem. We need to be clear. Even if you are uncomfortable in talking about this with them, I know I'm uncomfortable, you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. What about Mark 8? Get behind me, Satan, for you're not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. Boy, that's confronting sin head on. Right? Right after he confessed that Jesus was the Christ, the Son of God, when he found out that Christ, the Son of God, is going to die, he said, no, you're not. He said, you are not thinking the right way. This is wrong. You got to stop. Jesus addressed that head on. What about in John chapter 8? I'm only including verse 11, part of verse 11 on the screen. This is the story of the lady who was caught in adultery, and Jesus speaks to her and said to her, woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? And she said, no one, Lord. And Jesus said, neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on, sin no more. I love the line, nor do I condemn you. Because when he says, go on and sin no more, he's condemning the sin, is he not? It's a really powerful moment. When we address sin, do we have to speak in an ugly way? You might feel that, but if I bring up sin, it's ugly. Yes, sin is ugly. We don't have to be ugly, and we are trying to get them out of their ugliness. And there's a beautiful interaction here with Jesus and this woman, because when he said, sin no more, was he being light, or was he giving her the most demanding expectation? Sin no more? That's what he expects out of all of us. But we know the compassion and the mercy of Jesus. Sin is ugly, but speaking truth in love is light. In 1 John 2:11, whoever loves his brother abides in light, and in him there is no cause for stumbling. And so we need to work on this. I need to work on this. When I see something wrong, I need to talk to you. And when you see something wrong, you need to talk to them or to me. And we need to work on getting these interactions right. And we all need to remember that we are going to make some mistakes in this process. And so we need to be merciful. If I'm full of sin, and you're telling me about it, and you're not doing a very good job at telling me about it, I need to remember, well, I'm full of sin. And maybe I'll come back a week later and say, you know what? I think you could have been a little bit milder, or I don't know. We can talk about technique later on. We need to stop the sin right now. A last idea that I think is pretty important to think about is that we do this, I almost said we do it without control. We always are working on self-control. How many times does the Bible talk about self-control? Now, how many times did the Bible talk about other control? That's not what the Bible talks about. Look at Luke chapter 22. Not only the night, but the moment of Jesus' betrayal. Luke 22, starting in verse 47. While he was still speaking, there came a crowd, and the man called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. And he drew near to Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus said to him, "Judas, would you betray the Son of Man with a kiss?" And when those who were around him saw what would follow, they said, "Lord, shall we strike with the sword?" And one of them struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his right ear. But Jesus said, "No more of this." And he touched his ear and healed him. And Jesus said to the chief priests and officers and temples and elders who had come out against him, "Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs? When I was with you day after day in the temple, you did not lay hands on me. But this is your hour and the power of darkness." Who has absolute control in this scene? That's one of the great ideas in looking at Jesus' death. At Jesus' sacrifice, is that he's in control. He gets arrested and he gets taken by others. He goes and he follows along and he walks with and he puts up no resistance. Jesus has absolute control over himself, and it seems like it's almost like he has control over what's going on. But he doesn't actually control the people, does he? Jesus, let me sin. Jesus, let you sin. Jesus let that crowd come up and grab him and arrest him. That's amazing. Sometimes I wish Jesus just reached down and stopped me from sinning. But his job is to save me and forgive me. And my job is to stop through his power. Jesus lets sinners sin. What does that tell us about our interaction with other people? When Judas comes up, he says, "Judas, would you betray the Son of Man with a kiss?" Talk about words demanding meditation. Powerful question. I can only imagine how much that ate up Judas. And when they start fighting back, he says, "No more of this." He refuses to answer sin with sin. He won't let his disciples engage in that worldly behavior. He corrects the harm that they caused. And he acknowledges the reality. This is your hour and the power of darkness. That's sometimes the hardest thing for us to do, is to look at sin, or look at a broken situation, or look at a broken life, or look at all of that in the mirror, and admit, that's sin, that's a mess, I can't fix it, only God can fix it, I can't even make God fix it in his power. Jesus said, this is your hour and the power of darkness. Jesus teaches, Jesus warns, and Jesus allows choice and free will. What more can we do? You don't wrestle people into the waters of baptism. You don't force people to obey your will when you think you're trying to get them to obey God's will. You're really just forcing them to obey your will. We need to work hard at figuring out how to embody Christ's clear behavior here. One thing that we need to understand, though, is that Jesus withdraws his connection from this unrighteous darkness, doesn't it? Doesn't. Think about the three things that he said. Would you betray the Son of Man with a kiss? You think you're coming in here. You think you're just being all sweet, that we're friends and we're chums. I know what you're doing. You're using a kiss to do this. And it almost sounds like here in Luke's account that he refuses it from happening. I don't know. When his apostles are going to act like the rest of the world, he stops them and says, we are not going to act that way. And he is not engaging with the world in the worldly behavior. And he looks at the world as they're gathered all around him. He says, this is your hour. This is the power of darkness. And it's almost like Jesus is standing there in the light and they're in the dark. And he says, I'm not going to get mixed up in that. He has no fellowship with darkness. We have no fellowship with darkness. He doesn't just, well, okay, Judas, we'll just be chums. There's a break. And I think that that's important for us to remember. But Jesus was, of course, ready to welcome prodigals back home, right? Think about Luke 13, 34. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who were sent to it. He's so frustrated with Jerusalem. They're such a mess. How often I would have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, but you were not willing. Jesus was always standing there with open arms, ready to welcome you and me. And the only reason he didn't do that was because of you and me. And so we are there, and we are always ready, sharing the word, confronting sin when we see it, speaking calmly and clearly, not feeding hypocrisy, saying, I'm going to have no part of this darkness, but you need to realize what the sin is. And we're going to have to come up with ways of understanding, when do I need to break my connection? Or when do I need to wipe my hands of this sort of a mess? Good grief. All of those situations are going to require a lot of heart and a lot of thinking. Jesus knew like that. My tendency is to continue the relationship a little bit longer just to make sure I'm not making a worldly mistake. Okay, I think we're done. I'm going to give another month because maybe I don't see it clearly. But then I have to understand, maybe I need to just break my ties and move on and figure out who I can talk to. Psalm 107 has a couple neat interactions. I want to read instead Psalm 95. I put both up because I didn't know what I was going to read. But let's read Psalm 95. It is a startling psalm. Let's read Psalm 95 together. Oh, come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. Let us come into his presence with thanksgiving. Let us make a joyful noise to him with songs of praise. For the Lord is a great God and a great King above all gods. In his hands are the depths of the earth. The heights of the mountains are his also. The sea is his, for he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. Oh, come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God, and we are the sheep, the people of his pasture, and the sheep of his hand. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as at the day of Massah in the wilderness, when your fathers put me to the test and put me to the proof, though they had seen my work. For 40 years I loathed that generation and said, they are a people who go astray in their heart, and they have not known my ways. Therefore I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Did you see that ending coming? How could the beginning of this psalm lead into the ending of this psalm, right? It's some of the greatest praise you'll read in the Psalms. But we make mistakes. And we're foolish. And God comes right up to us, seemingly in the middle of our singing of praise in this song, and he says, you better listen up and do not act like your fathers acted. Do not seek those selfish ways. Do not try and test me, says the Lord. He wants us to trust him implicitly. Because if we walk down that path, just like he swore about them, he will swear about us that we will not enter his rest. And so that's the warning that Christ continually gave people. Sometimes just simply, calmly, with a simple statement or two to get us to think about, oh yeah, that I wasn't thinking right. Sometimes refusing to engage because our hypocrisy or our foolishness should not be nourished and fed. Sometimes we do something that's so bad that he comes right out and says, get behind me, Satan. Often because we have a friend or a loved one who's going to bring that up to us. And if we keep plodding along in our knuckleheaded ways, he's just going to turn to us and say, this is your hour, and this is the power of darkness. But there is an eternity of God's hour and an eternity of light that he is offering to us. We need to figure out how to talk to people, talk to ourselves, how to talk to people and engage with them the way Jesus did. Follow in his footsteps. Learn how to say, that's not right in the different situations that we encounter, just like Jesus. So that we can just focus on the first seven verses of this psalm. Now, I want to, don't ignore the second half of the psalm, but conceptually, if we are living the right way, the ending that is so scary, we won't have to worry about because we are devoted to God and we can just cycle back through these words of praise. Now, I don't know where you are in your walk and where you are in your journey, but you might need help and you might need prayers, and we want to help and we want to pray for you, and we want God to be big and important and a blessing in your life. If there's anyone who needs help or prayers, why don't you come forward as we stand and sing?